Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Musician's Main Talk Podcast. I'm your host, Travis Mark. And today, I am super stoked to announce the one and only Derek Bostrom from the Meat Puppets as my guest. Derek is a drummer, a songwriter, a super influential guy just overall. He's an artist, and that comes through pretty clearly in this interview. The Meat Puppets have been cited as a massive influence by bands like Dinosaur Jr., Soundgarden, Nirvana. In fact, they even appeared on Nirvana's MTV Unplugged album back in the 90s. So without further ado, ladies and gentlemen, the one and only Derek Bostrom.
Hello.
Hey, Derek, it's Travis. How's it going?
It's good. How are you doing?
Good. Thank you. Derek Bostrom from the Meat Puppets. What an honor. I mean, I can't even begin to tell you how many years I've been listening to your band. So the fact that you agreed to be a guest on this podcast is like a dream come true. I can't thank you enough.
Oh, thank you, Travis. It's a pleasure. I always love to talk about my craft. Believe me, it's one of the things that I like to do almost as much as I like to play music. Not quite, but almost.
That's incredible. Well, Derek, we're going to kind of get started with the interview here. And I know that straight off the bat, it's a little weird, but I do it with all my guests. And if you would be happy to indulge, please do. What I ask all my guests, just so our listeners have a better perspective of where you're coming from and who you are, instead of me doing like a big introduction, which I'll do post-recording of the interview anyway, how about you introduce us from your point of view? Tell us who Derek Bostrom is. Tell us what you're up to, what you've done, and just a few bullet points so that people know where your mind's at as we progress in this interview.
Well, I am a Phoenix native. I was born in Phoenix in 1960. I'm one of the few Phoenix natives. Well, you know, I mean, there's plenty of us, but the majority of people have moved here. So I've been here my whole life. So I have been a freak for the desert my whole life, which colors my attitude in a good way. But it does mean that I've come from a small town that became a big town over the course of my life. The Meat Puppets started in 1980 when I and the Chris and Kurt Kirkwood got together. We were, 70s teenagers. We liked to get high. We liked to dose, and we liked progressive music. I got into punk rock, and a lot of my friends poo-pooed it, but Kurt was interested in exploring it, and he shamed his younger brother Chris on bass into joining us, and we discovered that we were insane together, and we never looked back. We put out a series of records on the legendary SST Records label, home of Black Flag, Minutemen, Husker Du, and others, and we joined the cavalry that was heading towards the major labels in the 90s, did three albums with them, found the road on the majors pretty cutthroat, crashed and burned in the mid-90s, took a long break. Kurt resurfaced and started playing again around a couple of years later. Chris, who had gotten into trouble with the law, God bless him, rejoined the band once he had cleared that trouble up, and they had another drummer who played with them until about 2018, at which point I was asked to rejoin. In the process, I had gone to work and gotten married and become as straight a guy as I could, but it doesn't match the fun of being an alien, which I am by birth. So eventually the work thing ended and the band thing started up again. We have so far done a couple of records as this group. Now it's me, Chris, and Kurt with Kurt's son, Elmo, who is going to be 40 this year on guitar, and a friend of ours on keyboards named Ron Stabinski, who lives in Pennsylvania of all places. And, we run the gamut from we made our bones playing kind of country stuff, punk rock stuff, country punk, started getting confident enough to play too many notes. And eventually now we're like a five piece that plays a somewhat of a more ensemble sound. We get together very infrequently since Kurt lives in Austin, but I jam with Chris and Elmo regularly, and we kick up a shitstorm as a three-piece as well, and sometimes we go out and fiddle around with that three-piece separately from the Meat Puppets. But as far as where my head's at, I have found that, you know, in the early days when I was learning how to be a good rocker and a good musician, it was always a struggle, especially once we got into the majors and found ourselves being pressured to be what other people wanted us to be. Nowadays, it's pretty much pure pleasure. It's fun to be out on the road. It's fun to play. It's fun to hang out. And it's fun to do interviews. How's that?
That was incredible. That was very cool. I've got a few things I'll probably segue from. But before I do, let's just talk about the drum bug. I mean, how did that bug initially bite for you? And I suppose a bit of a naive question to ask, but had somebody told you back in 1980 that you would still be in the Meat Puppets, what would you have thought?
Well, I'll answer the second question first. The minute the three of us played together, I thought we were incredible. I thought we were going to like go all the way. Not necessarily to become the next Celine Dion or Elton John or something, but I thought we really had a strong thing to say to people, and I thought people would really relate to it. I am like an artist first, and when I think about my children, I think about my works of art, and I'm, you know, intuitively aware that they will outlast me. And I always had a big vision, long haul picture of this thing. And I thought we were going to not just be around for 40 years, but I thought we were going to be around forever. I think the Meat Puppets are great. I'm a big fan of the Meat Puppets.
Me too, brother.
So to answer your question, also another piece of that is it's all grist for my mill. Meat Puppets, Bostrom shit, Kirkwood shit. It's all good. I'm always looking towards my next project, and I keep busy. So I'm a pretty prodigious artist, musician, whatever. So to the extent that I worry about the next 40 years, it's minimal compared to what I'm, you know, what's on my plate right now. And right now, my piece of art that I'm working on is this wonderful interview I'm doing with this guy from New Orleans, who's originally from South Africa. So hold on to your hats. Now, to answer your first question, I'm 63, yeah, which means I came up during the era of the wonderful Ringo Starr,
yeah,
and his three collaborators. So drums, you know, we were all addicted to the big beat back in those days. I actually first started playing the drums after I had bought an album by a group called the Banana Splits, which was a TV, a Saturday morning live action TV show for kids, which featured four grown men in animal outfits pretending to be a rock band. And their record is really wonderful. And I used to put coffee cans on the backs of my chair and play along to the album. So my mom decided that she needed to give me a cheap set of drums, which I played for a while until my little brother wrecked them. And then I didn't get back into the drums until I heard punk rock. And I had a friend of mine who played guitar. And since I am such a bully, I managed to bully this poor, Jimi Hendrix fan type guy into writing semi-punk pop songs. Got myself another drum kit, thanks to my mom, and played with this guy until he moved away. And then I got involved with the Kirkwoods, at which point, believe it or not, I managed to steal a nice set of drums at some point along the way during my early punk rock days, and was able to expand my palate that way. So I got into the drums through a series of fan of bubblegum pop and theft.
I mean, listen, it's pretty damn rock and roll.
Yeah, well, that's what I say.
I mean, Nikki Sixx is famous for that, right? He stole that. He went to a guitar shop and stole a guitar thinking it was a bass and got to the rehearsal room and they were like, no, this is a guitar. So it's like, come on, man.
I'm not that Jim, but yeah. no, I think a lot of your artists are going to rely on things that fell off the back of a truck.
Yeah.
We've played our share of Franken instruments that are made out of stolen parts, kind of like the old Johnny Cash song, "One Piece at a Time."
Yeah.
If you know that one.
Yeah.
So the worm turns. And the next thing you know, it's 2 a.m. and all of your equipment is out on the sidewalk. So, you know, what goes around comes around, so to speak.
Oh, man. This sounds like a very interesting story.
Yeah, it's fun.
So, Derek, I mean, loaded question. And obviously, possibly a little bit too obvious because of the invent of social media and technology and stuff like that. But what do you personally regard as some of the biggest or weirdest changes in the music industry over the last 40 years? I mean, obviously back then, you know, the technology thing would have played a massive part, because now if you look at the average punter or concert goer, often they're on their phones or filming, and this always has to be considered by artists and stuff now. But without me jumping in on the question, what are your opinions on some of the biggest or weirdest changes?
Well, first of all, even before I got into the drums, I used to like to, you know, get two tape recorders together and make overdubs. And the Meat Puppets loved to do that. And we did it, you know, all the time. So shout out to Les Paul, who started overdubbing. And that's probably, you know, the hugest one in terms of like being able to make crazy shit that couldn't happen otherwise. So we'll just start with Les Paul and go from there. The advent of technology basically means it gets a lot cheaper. So, you know, we are able to do demos on our phones, you know, with programs like GarageBand or whatnot, and that's super cool. As far as you know, another great thing is that even though I am a professional musician, I am can't help but laud the internet for making every piece of music available to everyone for free, plus porn. So it's always, you know, the internet has been great for like piracy and pornography. And to the extent that it also fuels things like Arab Spring or January 6th, that's, you know, that's just, that's the price of entry, so to speak.
Yeah.
But also, back when we were doing this in the 90s, when we were in 1994, we had like a hit record out and we were as busy as hell and we were scrambling. It'd be things like, well, on Friday afternoon and Monday morning, you got to talk with the business people, right, to wind up your previous week and start your next one. And as it gets busy, it's like, you know, you're trying to communicate with people all over the country. And we had to use this thing called a phone card, and it was just a card that had like a 16-digit number on it, and in order to get long distance calls, you'd have to enter in this damn number with the keypad to the phone in usually a phone booth. And I mean, just that's crazy. When we were doing a one tour in the United States, we were trying to advance a tour in Europe, and we had a tour manager who at the time I tried to share a room with him, and he was an early user of technology. This would have been like 93, 94 in there. And he had a laptop, probably weighed, you know, 10 pounds, and a little fax machine gizmo, which was a dot matrix printer. And he would be faxing and getting faxes and sending faxes to Europe in the middle of the fucking night when we were all trying to sleep. And just those kinds of pre internet ways of trying to organize a tour could be very, very difficult and very, very time consuming compared to now. So, you know, technology, it's not just about making music. It's also about communicating. Makes things a lot easier. That said, We'll also talk about the social media part, which I'm not as big of a fan of, because it really has a tendency to pull your head out from what's important. Because you'll promote a show, you'll go on the usual Facebooks, Twitters, and whatnot, and try to promote a show, and every sucker in the world will comment saying, "Well, I don't care about your show. I want you to play in my town." And it's just like comment after comment after comment. It's like, yeah, but why aren't you playing with me? Why aren't you here? Why aren't you doing something other than what you're doing? It's like, no. This is an ad for what we're doing, not what we're not doing. I could like fill pages and pages and pages of what I'm not doing.
Yeah.
But people are weird like that. The assumption that we're expected to answer to people who don't have enough information to make intelligent comments, it can be daunting sometimes, because you can get lost in that shit and forget that once you get on stage, it's glorious. It's like you can make music be whatever you want it to be, and I find social media it's a bring down. I feel like there needs to be a certain level of friction between the artist, the musician, and the viewer, because that's where the magic happens, is in that space where expectation meets reality and your brain gets scrambled. And because you're anticipating an event, a live show, but until it happens, anything can happen. But then once it actually happens, something specifically happened. And that means you have to like get your head around, you have to break from the abstract and go into the real. And this is like jazz shit. It's like, what are you doing when you're watching something that's happening in front of you that's never happened before? How are you actually able to absorb it and appreciate it? And a lot of people, most people, do that by layering their preconceptions on top of it, and just that's as far as it goes. So you got artists that are actively, and this is what happened to us in the major label days, was like artists are actually being expected to reproduce their albums on stage. So, well, you used overdubs. That means you're going to have to hire a second guitarist. Don't do songs you don't know. We used to love to play like 45-minute encores of shit we didn't know and just like see how many mistakes we could make. That would be then turned into inspiration, right? And our label people would come back and go, people are leaving during that. And I was just like, yeah, but we're not.
Yeah.
Where do you think this music comes from, douchebags? The stage is a laboratory. If it weren't for us taking chances on stage, there would be no music. But they were just trying to like shut it down and make it something that it wasn't. Hmm. And I feel like too much of this social media stuff takes that on, because social media is nothing more than a bunch of ads, and people starting to think of themselves as brands instead of people. And they all want to have something to say. And that means that they have to come up with some horse shit that will, snarkily, piss on anybody else's statement, and it's just like, they're always trying to top each other. So it's like, we're playing in Phoenix. Well, you should be playing in Minneapolis. Well, I guess you told me, asshole.
Yeah.
So it's just like, even at the most basic level, there are a lot of people out there who are just automatically, because of course that's the nature of social media, right? It wants engagement, which means it's trying to piss you off, and it's trying to, create conflict, because that's how they make their money, by making us aggravated. And it's insane, because honestly, come to the show, have a beer, enjoy yourself, and then go the fuck home. It's just like, move on with your life and don't get strung out and hung up in this crap. So that was one of the big changes that technology, we're kind of wrapped up in it right now. Everybody is trying to get their head around what they're supposed to think. And my feeling is, you're not supposed to think.
Yeah. Living the moment a little,
Yep.
I find, I actually had this discussion with a promoter last night. Like, there's like good and bad parts to everything, right? And with the social media thing, I find in one way it can be quite good, but when you...
Well, it's cheaper. It makes it easier to get your word out, that's for sure.
Yeah, yeah. But to your point, I feel that some people, and I'm stereotyping here, of course, but I feel like some people have gotten too comfortable trying to spew their views on others. And I'm not meaning necessarily political or anything like that. I'm not going to go down that
path. No. That's just a symptom. The politics part is a symptom of a wider problem.
Yeah. I mean, just a silly example. And again, I'm not trying to turn this around that we're just talking, you know, shit now. But the other day, some guy was selling an old Ludwig drum kit on Marketplace, on Facebook Marketplace. And I reached out. He didn't have a price. Right? He didn't have a price. So I reached out and I was like, hey man, out of interest, how much are you looking to sell this kit for? And he was, well, how much would you pay? Now, I don't want to go into this game, right? So I'm just like, look, I don't want to insult you. You said you want to get rid of it in a hurry. So I thought I would reach out in case, you know, in case you're selling it at like a steal, you know? And man, he got so weird. I mean, of course you can't really tell the tone via text, but he was like, dude, why are you fucking insulting me like this? You know, just make me an offer already. Why would I give it away at a steal? And I'm like, dude, calm down. I'm not trying to be a hater in any way.
So I take it you didn't go see him.
Oh, I didn't go see him.
So what you didn't find out is he's actually a 10-year-old trying to sell his big brother's kit without his big brother knowing him. And he has no idea what it's worth.
Yeah, I mean, you're probably right. But I just thought it was weird how quickly the aggression escalated. Yeah. And I was like, this is so bizarre. Like, and I find that from my side, that's where things have gotten strange. It's like there's this sense of entitlement to talk to strangers in a way that, you know, if you did that to somebody on the street, you'd probably land up in prison because it's going to land up in some kind of altercation. And it's bizarre. Nonetheless, moving on.
Yeah, unfortunately, what you're saying is true. And you have to be really careful. You can also get your ass canceled, apparently, if you don't watch what you say.
Yeah.
The beauty of it is, and this is why it's such an engaging topic, is that it's actually really current. It's actually what we're worried about right now as humans. And so we can't help but get off into the sidebar. And, my point is to bring it back around is that it's very clear to me the difference between shit that don't walk and shit that does, which is to say, I love to get on stage and play music because the Meat Puppets, part of their trip has always been to keep it pretty loose, you know, as I alluded to during the stuff about playing songs we don't know. We started out like going, you know, the first thing we noticed was like the amazing energy. It wasn't like, oh my God, this sounds exactly like the Beatles record. It was like, this doesn't sound like anything we've ever heard before. And furthermore, it feels like nothing else. So I took like a 20-year break from playing the drums at all. And then the boys got back with me because we had been inducted into a local Phoenix musical hall of fame. There's a lot of great musicians in town. And I thought it was a bunch of shit, but somebody at work was like, wow, that's really cool. And it just occurred to me how much it means to people, which is funny when we're criticizing people for being on social media, but really, the friction between the fan and the artist. But the point is my head's so far up my own ass that it was like a revelation to me to hear what the Meat Puppets meant to a fan.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, this is actually really cool. This isn't lame. So I, you know, ended up talking to Kurt, who I hadn't talked to in a long time. And I discovered that he also thought it was a lame thing. Furthermore, he'd been refusing to be inducted for years. And it was only when they finally like pinned him up against the corner and said, dude, you need to do this. So he was like, man, if I can get Bostrom involved, then I'll do it. And so we were like, we both think this is a load of crap. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to get on stage and we're going to blow people's fucking minds because we haven't played together in 2 decades. We're going to get on stage and, you know, just show everybody what's what, because the world is so broken. And before the gig, somebody had, here's another change in technology, is the changes in marijuana technology. Now they have these concentrates and stuff. Yeah. Back in the old days, it was seeds and stems all the way down. But there was all these people like smoking these weird dabbing pens backstage. And I was all nervous because I hadn't played in 20 years. And next thing, I go to take a leak before we're supposed to go on. And I start to look at the wall in front of me and I realize, oh, my God, I'm high as hell. I've gotten secondary smoked big time and begin to just forget who I was, what I was. And I was literally walking around backstage going, so how does this work? So do you tell us to go on and then we go up there and play? Is that right? And people are like, yeah, yeah, yeah. And I was just like freaking out. And we get up on stage and for the first time in 20 years, it wasn't a musical thing. It wasn't an audio thing. It was a feeling. It was a feeling between the three of us that I hadn't felt in years. And the people in the crowd were crying. It was just like, oh, this is a really viable kind of a physical thing that a band does. And I don't think that we're the only band that has this. I think all great bands have it, but we definitely have it.
I agree.
And the thing about the Meat Puppets has always been something not just musical, not just artistic, but, you know, it's part of the law of physics. There's something about it that, you know, any fan of, you know, psychedelics or Robert Anton Wilson, Philip K. Dick, whatever, will tell you that there's a whole bunch of crap that we don't know. I think of it like this. Back in the old days, they used to apply leeches to you to address an issue that they thought leeches would address. Turns out the leeches wouldn't actually do anything. Why, they even killed one of our presidents because he had been wounded by being shot. But what he was killed by was them sticking their filthy fingers up inside the wound. So there are things that, like, doctors, technologists, engineers, whatever, tried to do to address issues that they thought they had. But those remedies didn't address the issue at all. I mean, how is introducing sepsis to a gunshot patient going to help him heal? It's like they didn't have any idea what they were doing. I think we're still like that. I think right now we're in a situation where there's a lot of issues that we've recognized problems, but we have no idea how to address them. I mean, carbon capture is not going to do it. So I think, you know, part of what always entranced me about making music was how unrational it was, about how it pointed to things that simply were counterintuitive on the face of it, but made a really good sense to me personally. And that's what makes me able to, to go the distance.
Talking of distance, and I know you've had your breaks along the way, and obviously Meat Puppets took a bit of a hiatus for a few years. But the fact that you guys, you know, you, Kurt and Chris, are still able to work together after so much time is really incredible. I mean, especially when you consider how most bandmates start to resent each other, or politics will set in and bands will break up, replace certain members, etc., etc., etc. Have you got any sort of advice, or could you potentially offer any sort of tips on how to, I don't know, try keep a band or a group together for as long as you guys have stayed?
Well, first of all, obviously you got to have money, unfortunately, to live. So if you can stay living with your parents for as long as you can, that helps. In terms of the resentments and the fights and the disagreements, all that's there. I have two brothers in the band, you know, there's all that family crap in there. But for me personally, getting back to what I said before, was when I first embraced this thing and I realized the power it had, I made the sacrifices that I needed to make. I didn't like them. and I didn't always succeed in making them. Sometimes I was called out for being a fifth wheel when I was trying to go along as best as I could. But really, for us, it boiled down to believing in what we were doing. We happened to be fortunate in that we had a couple of very gifted, well, three very gifted people in the band. But Kurt is really a special songwriter, a special lyricist, and a great guitar player. And he has a unique vision that we're all really into. So Kurt has a great way of leading the band, which is to say, if he doesn't feel like doing something, it doesn't happen. So, you know, he has a great way of insisting that you approach him the way he wants to be approached. So that kind of confidence when it comes to leadership, which I would say, you know, you would call it clear guidance in the work world. You know, you ask the average worker, what do they hate the most about their jobs? And that is being lied to, not knowing what the fuck they're expected to do, being asked to do things that aren't their job. It's rarely money and time. It has to do with, like, you know, not going crazy. So a good band is going to have strong leadership, strong vision, a strong sense of what they want to do. And the Meat Puppets, despite the fact that we were like three crazy, you know, kids from the desert, always believed that we could go the distance, that we had something to offer, and we wanted to make the sacrifices that we needed to make in order to do that. That means family. That means money. That means time. That means health. You know, it's like sometimes, you know, the train grounds to a halt, and you just have to say to yourself, all right, there's a reason for this. So it's like, well, I can't do this show because I got food poisoning the night before. We're going to have to cancel. Okay, that's understandable. I've got two twins. I'm going to need to, like, spend more time with my family and less time on the road. And when I do go on the road, I'm going to be extra crabby because I'm leaving two infant twins behind. And you have to just say to yourself, I understand that. You know, it's like getting on the, you know, you have to also understand that if you're going to make any money at this, you have to do it a certain way. When we were in the 80s, we were on the road constantly. And we were scrambling to get t-shirts, you know, merchandise sales and stuff like that. That was always a pain because you either did it yourself or you had to drag another person around, which increased your costs. When we were first starting out, we were doing, like, we were sleeping on people's floors, playing for private parties for $25 a night and driving 500 miles in between these gigs. That was when we were still, like I said, living with our parents. And, you know, I think the first gig that we ever did, Chris told his mom that he and Kurt were going camping that weekend, and we snuck off to California with mom's truck. You know, things like that, you know. So I think what the trick to sticking with it is wanting to. I mean, that's the key to it. We also used to fight over whether or not we were good enough. It was like, we need to practice more. You need to practice more. You need to practice your singing. When we got onto the major label, they were like, Kurt, we need you to take vocal lessons. And he was like, fuck you. But eventually he did it. And he learned a couple of simple things, like singing from your chest instead of your head, you know, things like that, little adjustments that really help. So I think not only an important part of sticking with the band is to be able to take guidance and to be able to take direction. You simply cannot collaborate in a group if you can't take direction. And it's hard, especially when, I mean, I started my band when I was 19, Chris was 19, Kurt was 20, 21. We were young. And since we were liked right off the bat, we got thrown into the deep end of the pool relatively quickly. So we were, another good tip, by the way, is to really hate working, is to really hate the 9 to 5.
That's amazing.
If you hate the job, working for the man enough, you'll do anything it takes to avoid it. And that includes, you know, living at your parents. God, I could tell you horror stories about roaches, you know, and stuff like that. And then, of course, you know, as a band that was really into pot, you got to be careful of how high you're going to get and what and how illegally you're going to travel. My wife recently bought me this book. This is like a really thick manual for the touring musician. I don't have the name of it right now. She keeps saying, "You need to read this. You need to read this." And I'm like, "Man, I wrote that." But it's like, you know, you got to stay healthy. You can't not argue if there are problems, but you got to be able to take direction and you got to be able to suck it up. I remember a situation back when we were really grinding. We had a tour cycle in 86 when our roadie slammed Kurt's finger in the van and broke it in two places. And we were just starting out this tour, so we had to cancel everything. And then he went back and mended for 2 months, relearned how to play the guitar, and boy, oh boy, he was pissed. You know, he had the two twins. That was how we made money. He didn't even know if he was ever going to be able to play again. Eventually, we had to get back on the road, but we had to make up these shows. And the tour, the promoters were kind of like ticked at us, and we were playing, and this was like places out in the middle of nowhere. And we ended up like going out in the summer. And we were going to do these shows in, you know, before school was out. And then we made them up in the summer, and it wasn't a great tour. And it was just, you know, things like that. And we managed. And I remember one argument I had with my bass player where we were going into Canada and we had all this merchandise. And I was like, we can't bring these T-shirts in there. They're not going to let us like sell stuff in there. And my bass player's like, screw that. We're going. We're going to do it. And I was like, whatever, they're not going to let us. We get to the border and they're like, yeah, you can't bring that shit in there. And I didn't get the luxury of saying, I told you so, because he turned right around on me, my bass player, and said, if you really believed in something, you should have convinced me. And I was like, you asshole.
So it's always the drummer's fault, man.
Oh, of course. Shit always rolls downhill. That's another thing you have to either come to grips with or work on is, you know, there are times when shit rolls downhill, but, you know, that means we're like 2 a.m. trying to find a place to stash the, you know, thousands of dollars worth of T-shirts that are just in these beat up cardboard boxes. We find like a gas station with lockers in it and stuff like that. And then we get back there, you know, and another time we go across the border. And anytime we used to go across the border back there in those old days is we would have this massive, you know, paranoia about getting caught with weed. And so we would clean our car out really good because you never know, you know, what's going to be, you know, in the seat cushions. Right. And one time they found something. It was just like some crumb. So, of course, they tore the van up and they threatened to arrest us, blah, blah, blah. And they didn't find anything. But they tore the van up and it took them like hours and hours and hours. So we got to the show very late and we were doing well at the time. And it was a big show. And we got there, you know, late to the gig, let alone not being able to sound check. So we were able to find out on stage that the fuckers had broken our amp. Oh. And so we're on stage going, well, we're going to have to fuck around with our equipment here in front of all 1,000 of you. And that really stinks. That's not fun. And, you know, the next time we went through town, we were at a much smaller venue with much less people. So, but the thing is like, it was agonizing at the time. Now it just makes for a good anecdote to share on a podcast, right?
Oh, completely, completely. So with all of your experience, I mean, we're talking decades of experience here. And obviously with all your know-how and expertise, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. If you were to launch an artist or a band in the current state of the music industry, what would your approach be?
We've actually been doing some of this because the Meat Puppets are on a hiatus right now. And the three of us who live in town are itching to play. So we've been seeing if anybody wants to put on shows with us. And from my experience, you know, I know some people, the easiest route to stardom is to have your mom buy you a YouTube ad, you know, based, you know, situation. I know that there have been people who appear on TV and then get popular, or they put out something on YouTube and they spend the requisite amount of money to advertise it. Or maybe you can dance like Michael Jackson, so you get on TikTok, and the next thing you know, you get a sneaker endorsement, and your dad is your manager, and all that crap. Fuck that. That's not what I'm into. Start small, you know. Don't be afraid to make mistakes on stage. Embrace your friends, you know, network in the real sense of the word. You know, if you got buddies who like you and you like them, you should get together and do stuff. I mean, that's all I'm, you know, like, I'm the same as you. I look on Facebook Marketplace to try to find good deals so I can buy more equipment, and have fun. Jesus Christ. Don't worry about sounding like, I don't know, even know who you're supposed to sound like. And again, I'm just a rocker guy. I'm an old rocker guy. Nobody, you asked me the question, if I was launching a band right now, I'd probably say, here's the thing. If you're in a rock and roll band anymore, automatically half the country thinks you're a redneck, because rock and roll is like not cool. It's white boy music. It's red state music. So, you know, there's five of us. We're all white. We're all old. We're all straight, at least I think. And that sometimes I saw a thing where when they released that the new Revolver reissue, you know, the deluxe edition of Beatles Revolver. And I saw snarky comments saying anybody who likes the Beatles is guilty of white privilege. And I was like, well, I can't argue with that.
So I think, like, I saw that, you know, I think, yeah. I saw that going around. Yeah.
So it's like, so what are you going to do? It's like, I'll tell you what, if you don't have the courage of your own convictions, doesn't matter what you sound like. I mean, you know, black artists, gay artists, they have the same situation. They feel under the gun. They need to have the courage of their convictions to do the things they need to do. So do I. The Meat Puppets have never had a big, support system. It's always been us trying to do the best we can. And you know, I don't think people realize that a lot of times. Just because you're quote unquote famous, it doesn't mean that you got a pot to piss in, or that you're not constantly under the gun from people giving you a hard time. So certainly, you know, the early rockers had that problem. I read that book that came out, I think it was earlier this year, about Chuck Berry. And he was a man who definitely had the courage of his convictions, but he was a freak. And I'm like going, is he canceled because he put cameras in the women's toilets at his club? He may very well be to a lot of people, but that doesn't change the fact that the guy has, you and I could sit here and name 30 songs of his that he wrote that are stone classics.
Yeah, and it could even be argued that, you know, the guy pretty much invented rock and roll, man.
Well, he certainly he put a twist on it that we're still using. And but it's like, okay, so we like some of Chuck's songs, or even if we don't like them, we acknowledge that they're fantastic. But he put cameras in the women's restrooms of his club. So where do you draw the line? And obviously, Bruce Springsteen used to say, trust the art, not the artist. I certainly agree with that. Only
because that's a great way to look at it.
The thing is that there is a huge difference between the art and the artist. The first thing you realize when you put out a piece of art into the world is that it's no longer yours. And that gets back to social media and, you know, personal branding and all that stuff. Regardless of what I think of my work, other people think about it. And when I, first learned about this, it's like, this Beatles record, what's interesting about it is that they got together on this specific time with this specific technology, and people are like, no, this song reminds me of the time that I went shopping with my mom when I was a kid. It's like, oh, well, that's a very different way of looking at the music. So you just can't, you can't take any of it for granted. You gotta be aware of everything. But really, the ultimate answer I have to give to you is, I couldn't even begin to advise another person how to live their life. And I wouldn't presume to. You ask me what would my advice be to a younger person? Let's be clear. I'm bridging to say, what would I tell myself? I would not presume to tell another person how to live their life. I don't think that that's a good way to live my life. So, you know, all I can tell you is, you know, what they used to say, don't quit your day job. You know, what's your advice to young people starting out? Don't do it, you know, or if you're going to do it, party on, motherfucker. Do it hard.
Yeah, well, I think you kind of nailed it. Have fun, you know, just have some fun. If you'd be willing, I'd like to, for a second, talk about when the Meat Puppets worked with Nirvana. Mm-hmm. Now, I know for, like, the Unplugged show, obviously they didn't call on an extra drummer, but, you know, the Kurt and Chris went out there. But you got any cool Kurt Cobain stories or any Nirvana stories that maybe you want to share with us? I know you guys did the support slot in Utero tour, I think. What was that like? I mean, that must have been kind of crazy given sort of the megastar that he had become at that point.
Well, it's unfortunate for him that he did become a megastar. I'll tell you that much. The first thing about Nirvana is that, you know, we'd signed a major label contract in the summer of 1990. We put out our first major label record in 1991. At that time, there was all sorts of fighting with the label as to how to best present us. And we went through many producers that they didn't want us to use. They didn't want to use, and we didn't want to use. We finally settled on Pete Anderson, who was the guitar player and producer for Dwight Yoakam, because the label thought it would be a good idea to get, because Dwight was kind of rock and roll country, you know. He was kind of a Buck Owens kind of a fan, so they thought that would be a good way to broach that. To present the Meat Puppets in kind of a country-ish root rock kind of a format. Well, it's a great record. It's not perfect, but it comes out and, like, right around the same time Nevermind comes out, which pretty much just kicks the idea of anybody caring about country punk in the ass, and it became grunge. The next thing you know, the label's like, well, next time we're going to do it, we're going to have to do it. You guys are going to need to be like grunge, because that's what's popular now. And we're like, fuck you. We can't be like ourselves. So we had to fight with them again because styles had changed. And so Nirvana changed the game for everybody. It gave some people opportunities. It gave it shut the door for other people. But what really happened was a lot of very fragile artists got a chance to get in way over their heads, ourselves included. And you look at these bands that got popular during that early 90s frame, a lot of people struggled. And the ones that succeeded were ones that were very careerist, very comparatively mainstream when compared to the Meat Puppets. Bands like, and all of these bands had their own struggles. I'm not saying that, like, they were different from us, but their style was a little bit more marketable by the powers that be. And I'll just not name any names, but let's just say that the fight to market the Meat Puppets was real and painful to us. And we went through a lot of back and forth and wasted a lot of money trying to figure out what we were. And we got lucky. We got lucky because, right, you know, a month before we were going to release Too High to Die, our second major label release, we appeared on Unplugged, and that gave the label, you know, a toehold. And, you know, you got in your record labels, you've got, like, the promotional side, the radio side, you know, the A&R side. All these people have got their jobs to do. And in this particular case, that Nirvana thing allowed our radio people to really dig in, and it really helped us. We got one of our songs got as high as, like, number two on the alternative chart, which was a thing back then. And so, you know, Nirvana, you know, basically gave the label the legs to really push us. Now, Nirvana at the time, they were really into, you know, Kurt Cobain was really into all the bands that they'd come up with, Meat Puppets, Daniel Johnston, you know, half Japanese, all these groups that, you know, he was into cool bands. He wasn't just into whatever, Vaseline's, you know. So what they ended up doing was trying to get as many bands that they liked to open for them as possible. And this was the same thing back in the early days when we were first starting out. The band that had the toehold wasn't really a punk band. It was more of kind of a power pop band, but it was a band that knew the clubs, and they were able to get their own following and then bring in their little friends through the back door, which kind of gets back to my, you know, my statement earlier about like getting together with your friends and local networking. So this was simply a case of like, you know, friends, buds. We had seen that Kurt Cobain was talking about in Spin magazine about how much he liked the Meat Puppets and how he was trying to get Courtney into Meat Puppets too, and she didn't get it until he played the songs for her in his own style, and then she decided it was okay, and we were like, that's interesting. Meanwhile, they were like doing, you know, like they would give one band four shows, another band four shows. So they gave us four shows, and we did like, you know, four shows with them, but they just happened to be the four shows right before they went to do Unplugged. And Cobain was like, Kurt, teach me like Fire and whatever else we did, Plateau and stuff like that, so I can do it on Unplugged. Because he wanted the Unplugged thing to be special. He wanted it to be unique. And by the end of the tours that we were doing, he's like, why don't you guys just come on stage with me? Because again, he needed the support of his people because he was feeling overwhelmed. So having us along somehow helped him to, you know, to just feel more confident. And the MTV people were like, what? Who are these losers? We don't want these guys on there. So it helped. You know, it was like, it was just what he was looking for, was a little bit of people from the old neighborhood to help him, you know, broach the MTV, you know, moat. And it was really good for us. We'll never know if it was good for him because he was already in such a difficult spiral that we weren't able to do anything else with them. But it launched us into like a really busy year. 1994 was profoundly busy for us. And you know, we didn't survive 1994 either. We struggled through another year and another record. And by that time, the styles were changing again, and we were moving into, you know, boy band territory or Spice Girls territory. And by the time our last major label record came out, the label didn't have as much, you know, promotional weight behind it as they could have. I'm not saying that there was a meeting between Mr. Biggs saying, we're going to dump these guys, but it's a difficult business. And we're not a commercial band, and we tried to put our best foot forward, and we ended up just having to like basically stop. And then it took a lot of effort to disentangle ourselves from our major label contract, because a lot of times, you know, you'll sign like a 9-album deal with a label, and they'll bury your ass. They'll like go, well, we don't want to put any records out with you, but we're not going to release you. So we had to pay to get out of it. And you know, we're free now, and we can do what we want, and we have a very sympathetic record label, and we're getting ready to re-release all of our SST records it's not like they've been super out of print, but we have a new, you know, we're re-releasing them, and we're doing things like releasing the first the EP, the In a Car EP from 81 on vinyl for the first time in like decades, probably since the 80s. And we're releasing an album of covers, of country covers from 1994, called Camp Songs, which will come out this fall. And we're gonna do re-release the Live in Montana record that we did with Ryko Disc back in 1999 for the first time on vinyl, and try to get that involved in Record Store Day next year. And so we've got stuff coming out. And we're doing, and meanwhile, like, you know, Elmo Kirkwood and I have our own little podcast, and I've been doing more stuff on Bandcamp, and, you know, just trying to like spread out the, you know, the opportunities a little bit, because the old dinosaur ways of putting out a record, going through retail, that's very important. And we love our retailers, and the nice thing about our record company is that we can, you know, work with retailers and, you know, do things like, they want us a big retailer back east will want an exclusive color vinyl or something like that. And you could do stuff like that today, and that makes a lot of difference. Record Store Day is fun because you can do a limited edition and sell it out and, you know, do well with it. We did a live album a couple years back with a label. It's called Manchester 2019, where we had got a really good multi-track recording when we were out in Manchester, England, of all places, and released it on vinyl only. It was a picture disc, and it was like a limited release, but it's fun to do these smaller things. You don't have to like say to yourself, well, if I don't sell 500,000 copies, it's a failure. Now, I have sold 500,000 copies. In fact, in the back room, I have my gold record up on the wall right next to my wife's college diploma. That's, you know, that's my sheepskin.
Yeah, but, exactly.
Nowadays, if you can sell 2,500, as long as you keep your costs down, which you can, you can still have a career and have fun with it.
Yeah.
And the important thing is to not work if you don't feel like it.
Yeah, because, you know, you want that inspiration to be genuine.
Yeah, you want it to stay fun, and you want to make sure that you're not making the band something that it shouldn't be, which is a burden. And I watched, you know, when we were first getting popular, we got a 4-star review in Rolling Stone magazine for Meat Puppets 2 when we were on the road to Black Flag, and that changed a lot of things. First of all, it made Black Flag irritated. And it also meant that suddenly we were like, wait a minute, our records aren't in the stores. Like SST couldn't keep up with the demand, and we were like, well, fuck. And then we started getting we released Up on the Sun, which people really liked, and that was when like REM was coming up, and they were giving REM a ton of shit too, like going, these guys, they need to make their vocals louder and make their stuff less obscure, blah, blah, blah. And of course they knuckled down, and you can bet that they had their share of infighting. And we put out this very nice record, and then we started doing these shows. I'll be goddamned if in 1985, in promoting this Up in the Sun record, which was like, you know, at the time we got on the college charts, and that was a big deal for us. But we were doing like covers. We were doing like Elvis covers twice as fast, and like, you know, songs that we half knew, and not at all, quote unquote, reproducing the album on stage, unquote. And reviewers noticed. They're like, yeah, these guys are a fluke. They're not good. Their record is good, but the singing's not good, and they're really unprofessional, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, we had, and meanwhile, you know, like Husker Du, Replacements, they're getting signed to the majors. And we did a little bit of sniffing around, and they were just like, yeah, you guys are too weird. We don't know what to do with you guys. Check in with us when you learn how to play it straighter. And we're like, well, fuck. And it was like not good for us. It was like we felt like we were getting bypassed. And, you know, even now, my bass player is like, it should have been us instead of you two. Brian Eno should have taken us in hand. I'm like, yeah, probably, but it didn't happen. So,
but I mean, there are so many just great bands that have publicly listed you guys as influences. I mean, some of my favorite bands were their favorite bands, you know? So like Dinosaur Jr., Soundgarden, there's so many good ones. So, I mean, I know that, you know, it's easy for me to say because I've not lived your life, but I think you guys have something special and always did, and it's killer.
That was what we. I'm just telling you about some of the weird inside baseball shit that happens.
Oh,
while,
of course,
while yeah. You're sticking to your guns, but absolutely, to the extent that we can, you know, people say that, you know, it's like, you know, influences is always kind of a stupid thing. So, what are your influences? And what I come to realize is that the reason we quote unquote influence these bands is not because of the way we sound so much, is that the way that we fucking stayed, you know, street level or what, or, you know, tried to keep it real and all that kind of shit, provided a certain level of inspiration for what you can do if you want to just do your own shit. And, the way you can, it's like all the rock, the story of rock and roll. It's like the story of who survived and who didn't, you know. Elvis didn't, Jerry Lee Lewis did. Elvis got addicted to drugs. Jerry Lee Lewis literally killed people and got away with it. You know, Chuck Berry stuck to his guns, and Little Richard, you know, Little Richard was out there playing shitholes, you know, with Tiny Tim's manager or whatever, and screaming to the world, "No, it's me. You guys need to pay more attention to me. I'm the shit." And even at the very end, he was like, he'd get on stage and go, "You guys suck. I'm great." And that's actually, you know, it's like, you might like say to yourself, "Ooh, that kind of smells weird." But then when you think about it and, you know, time passes, you realize he was right.
Yeah. No, he was totally right.
Depends on what you're into, I suppose. But when the rubber hits the road, you know, who's your daddy, man? Is it fucking, is it your fellow South African Elon Musk, or is it, you know, Chuck Berry?
Yeah, exactly. And again, it's where you're at in your personal life, right? Because that will affect your view on the day. And people now change day to day. It's I'm not saying you can't do what you like, but it is interesting. This topic of sticking to your guns, it definitely is something that a lot of people, I mean, I've been in rooms with musicians, and I'm stereotyping it to musicians because that's what I do. But I've been in rooms with musicians who, you know, hypothetically, one musician in the room will say, "Hey, we should play the song like this," and someone in that band will go, "Yeah, that's great." And then the other musician in the same band will be like, "No, I don't like that." And the same musician who just said that was great goes, "Oh yeah, yeah, me neither." And it's like,
"Oh yeah,
come on, man,
you do it."
Just you know, like. Anyway, so I have one last question for you, sir.
Okay.
It's a bit of a loaded one. I ask all my guests, but I'm going to put a little twist on yours.
All right.
What I typically ask is, what do you think has been the best piece of advice you've ever received? But I'm going to change it for you slightly, and rather I'm going to ask, what do you think has been the greatest lesson you've learned along the way?
Oh, that's easy. Keep out of trouble with the IRS.
Amazing. I love that. That's actually yourself and Brandon Lee from Flickerstick have now both given me just incredible last answers. Thank you, sir.
Well, I'll tell you what, I've been in trouble with the IRS more than once in my life. It can be a real drain.
Damn. Yeah, I can believe it, man.
But really, you know, it is such a loaded question. There are so many great pieces of advice. I think the greatest, a lot of the best pieces of advice are advice that I figured out myself without anybody telling me.
Yeah.
You know, so nobody ever sat me down. I remember one time when I met Chris and Kurt's dad, he wanted to give me a good piece of advice, and that was that Dukakis was a very dangerous man. And, you know, that's, advice opinions are like assholes. A lot of it boils down to what you learn. So nobody ever sat me down and told me to avoid the IRS. I had to learn that the hard way. So I'll be honest with you. Nobody ever gave me any great advice. Honestly, what I mentioned earlier, Chris saying to me, "If you believe in something, you need to convince me." That's actually pretty damn good advice if you think about it.
Yeah, it's great advice.
So
it really is.
I don't give quick and easy answers.
All right, Derek, dude, thank you so very much for your time. This was a really fun interview for me. I've done a few of these now, and you know, like I said at the beginning, huge fan of your work. So thank you for taking the time, and thanks for just sharing some of your insight with us, man.
Well, it was my pleasure. I love to talk about my crap, like I said, and I'm really glad that other people want to hear it. It makes a big difference, so I appreciate it.
Amazing. All right, buddy. I'll talk to you soon. Bye.
All right, bye.
Sweet. Derek Bostrom, everybody. Thanks, Derek, for your time. I urge all of my listeners to please go check out the Meat Puppets. Go check out Derek. See what they're up to. They're a great band. As usual, thank you for your time if you're still listening. Please do us a favor, leave us a rating or review, or even share us with like-minded individuals who you feel might get something out of these conversations. You can find out more about The Musician's Mentor at musicians-mentor.com. My name's Travis Mark, And if you have anything that you would like me to start asking these guests that I bring on the show, please drop me a DM. I will gladly get it done for you. Until next time, keep pushing. Peace.